Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Live to you from the front lines on the campaign to reelect President Trump. This speech I gave to over 500 young people and hundreds of voters in Texas recently. You guys are going to love this conversation. Did the parties switch? Why is it that it seems as if we're using different terms when it comes to racism when we talk to the left? We talk about President Trump's chances and so much more. Email us your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com. And if you want to help support our surge right now, where we are going harder than ever, our crusade to reelect our president, charliekirk.com/support. If you listen to this podcast and you say, I just want more young people to hear the truth, this is your vehicle. charliekirk.com/support. We have an election to win, everybody. 6 days. Do your part. Buckle up. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hey, everybody. Awesome to be here. 7 days to put all this together. And we've been doing almost a new state every single day. We did 7 speeches over the weekend. We're heading to Florida after this. We'll be back in Texas. And we're doing 2 podcasts a day, 2 hours of radio a day. And there really is something special happening in this country. I feel that we might be on the verge of the next great awakening. And I mean that spiritually. I mean that politically. I see people that are wanting to recommit their activism, their time, their energy, their resources to this unbelievable gift that we have been given. And that's what this country is that we've been given a gift. As mentioned, we've made plenty of mistakes in our country's past, but America is not a mistake. This country that we have been given is the most benevolent, charitable, forward-thinking, generous, open-minded country ever to exist in the history of the world. And this country, thank you, it's true. And this country will survive or disintegrate based solely on our ability to communicate our values to the next generation. It's that simple. And with us tonight are many Turning Point USA chapter leaders. In fact, I think we have some from Highland Park High School. Stand up, Turning Point USA chapter leaders. Thank you guys for being here tonight. Give it up for our young freedom fighters. Thank you guys. And so I want to talk about a couple things tonight. I'm sure all of you want to know about the election, and we can get into that. We'll take some questions on it. But first, I want to just kind of establish the framework of something a lot bigger than just the election. Because if President Trump wins, and I hope he does, a lot of these problems are not going away. If President Trump wins, there will only be so many more elections that we can survive narrowly with an ever-growing generation that does not have gratitude to live in this country. According to Gallup, only 43% of my generation thinks that America is a good country. That's not sustainable. The country cannot survive if the younger generation with the energy and the ambition, the entrepreneurial spirit, has lost complete and total faith in this gift that we have been given. And so what we do at Turning Point USA, through digital social media, through going on campuses, high school campuses, is our job is very simple. We want our kids to love America again. We want to teach the next generation why this country is different, why we are exceptional. So we've done a very poor job of that over the last couple decades. We acted as if it was automatic. I was born in 1993. A couple years before that, the Berlin Wall fell. And a lot of parents in the 1990s, after that wall fell, I think consciously or subconsciously thought with that, the fight against collectivist Marxist ideas was over. And with that, the 1990s, we saw record prosperity, growth, incredible amounts of abundance, spreading of entrepreneurial activity, the likes of which our country has never seen before. And with that, a lot of people in this country, primarily my parents' generation, we kind of allowed the left to take over many of our core institutions in our country. And now we are seeing what has happened as a byproduct of that. And One of the things that frustrates me the most when I go to these university campuses is I'm not even talking about conservative versus liberal. I have to first convince young people that this country is not awful. My basis point, my starting point, is trying to convince young people that this country was not founded on slavery, instead it was founded on freedom, that this country has a heroic story to be told, that this country was built by titans, by forward-thinking individuals, by heroes. And that's where we must start. And so let's just start there. In the last couple months, we have had an unrelenting campaign by mass media, social media, by the most powerful people in our country to convince you that we live in an awful country. The first thing that they say is that this country was founded in 1619, not in 1776. Whether you know it or not, many of your children are being taught this in public schools across the country. It's called the 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones. Let me be very clear. Nicole Hannah-Jones produced a pile of garbage when she is teaching your children. It is completely and totally untrue. There was something special that happened in 1776. When our Declaration of Independence was written, it was our birth certificate, but there was no guarantee it was going to be our birth certificate. It very well could have been our death certificate. It was one of the most uncertain documents ever written on the history of the planet. It starts with when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary to dissolve ties. What were they really talking about? They were telling King George, you're not in control. They were saying that our rights don't come from King George or from government, but they come from God. This document that quite honestly has kind of been cast aside in the communication of the history of our children was such an unbelievable leap forward for humanity, where it mentions God four times. 51 out of 55 signers of the Declaration of Independence were Bible-believing, regular attending Christians. It was the first great awakening in our country that started the philosophical framework that allowed this document to even be conceptualized. But the most amazing part about the Declaration of Independence was not even the boldness or the courage, but it was the uncertainty. It was that the people that signed it had no idea what came next. It was a declaration that very well could have been, as I mentioned, a death sentence. What came after, of course, is a bloody revolution that we won. And then the question is, what do you do? What kind of government do you create? Well, our founders very well could have created the Washingtonian, Franklin, Jeffersonian ruling class. They could have divided the states up for themselves. They could have become kings and queens and monarchs, because that's all human history knew for the past 1500 years, with maybe a couple little blips of the radar of small little democratic experiments. The founding fathers were the first group of people to win a war and then give up power. It's never happened before. You win a war, usually keep the power. You sacrifice everything. Usually you want to keep the spoils for yourself. They went so far in the United States Constitution to reject this idea that in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4 of the United States Constitution, it says that bloodline and titles of nobility will be rejected in this new country and this republic. We are the longest lasting, longest standing country ever to exist to have the same framework from our founding to where we are today. Why? In France, they change their constitution every other month. In every single banana republic, they're always going through another constitutional crisis. Why is it that the words that were theorized and written in 87 and 91 when it was ratified, the Bill of Rights was ratified, why does it stead the test of time? Because the Constitution was not written for the times. It was written to stand the test of time because it took human nature as a constant. It said that human beings naturally want to gain as much power as possible, that human beings want to centralize their authority over others. And we have to do everything we possibly can to make sure that tyrannical, charismatic, and quite honestly, misleading people do not use that power and abuse it. So that's where we came up with the idea of checks and balances, which was derived from Montesquieu. That's where they came up with the idea of freedom of assembly and Second Amendment rights. But what's so amazing about the United States Constitution, it's not rules for you. It's first and foremost rules for our government. It's what the government cannot do to you. It's recognizing that the government is the greatest abuser, first and foremost, of human liberties and freedoms, that people deserve the right to be free because that's how we were born and that's how we were made in what? The image of God, a uniquely American idea. Now, people say we are founded on slavery. This is rubbish. It's not true. In the United States Constitution, 20 years after the ratification, it put a sunset clause saying that the importation of new slaves into the United States will not be allowed. Thomas Jefferson, the third American president, being a slave owner himself in 1807, had a real big moment Will I actually sign the abolition of new slaves coming to the U.S. or no? And he did. Highly complex, very complicated man, but he did a moral good for our country. And we do a disservice to our young people not to communicate people that were wrestling with the times and did something good for humanity. Yet we're taking down statues of Thomas Jefferson. University of Virginia is trying to abolish him from their entire history. That man was a hero for our country. He created the framework for everything that we enjoy today. George Washington said no new slaves in Northwest Territories. Vermont abolished slavery 1 year after the Declaration was ratified in 1776. In 1777, they abolished slavery. The question should never be whether or not a civilization had slavery. The question should be, did you get rid of it and why? Every single civilization prior to America had human ownership of human beings. Everyone. It's a brutal truth. The question should be then, why did you get rid of it? And how? And of course, it was a bloody civil war. There was a conflict. Despite all of that, our union stayed together and we abolished the unspeakable sin of slavery. Before we get on our moral high horse and we act as if we've actually abolished slavery worldwide, there's more slaves on the planet today than there were back then. Just go to the Horn of Africa or go to the Middle East, or look at the sex trafficking happen all throughout Central and South America. More people have found more opportunity thanks to the American Enlightenment ideas, more so than any other philosophical framework in the history of the planet. This country has produced more wealth, more opportunity for more people of any single skin color imaginable than any other experiment. The question is, why all of a sudden are we trying to stop it? Why is it the country that has more Nobel Prizes than any other country, more gold medals, first to the moon, first to space, first to the moon, first to flight, open heart surgery, brain surgery, more medical innovations? Why is it this country, founded on the American Trinity of In God We Trust, Liberty, and E Pluribus Unum, why all of a sudden are we trying to go the other direction and almost entertain an American suicide? Why are we doing this? And the reason is very simple, because as we have removed a moral backing from our country and we had more abundance than we could ever possibly imagine, all of a sudden liberty breeds apathy. And when you have liberty, there will inevitably be inequality. It's impossible to have liberty without inequality. Some people will work harder. Some people will apply themselves better. Some people will make good choices. Some people will make bad choices. With that, you'll have unequal outcomes. The question is, what do you do about it? Well, when you have unequal outcomes, certain people then are going to try to use demagoguery, division, and class warfare to try to attain power. And so over the last couple decades, we removed the moral backing from our country. We have become more secular, more removed from moral teaching, more godless. Yet we have more devices that allow it easier than ever for us to indulge in things that do not make us more prosperous, more happy, or more content. I'm talking about the supercomputers that all of you have in your right-hand pocket. So now we have a generation in our country that can have anything they want at any time, at instant notice, and they're the most miserable generation in American history. They have more stuff, more opportunity, more capacity and information, yet they are the most suicidal, most depressed, most anxious, least happy generation ever. How did that happen? It's because liberty only works if you know how to handle liberty. It's a very interesting point that I, quite honestly, in the last 6 months, I've been wrestling with. Because if you have unlimited liberty and you don't know how to handle it with abundance that goes with it, you'll soon be a slave to those devices and to those actions with it. We made an unbelievable mistake in the last 6 months. In fact, I've done a lot of research on this. The lockdowns will go down as one of the worst decisions ever made in the history of our country, bar none. The lockdowns, we need to say it so it'll never happen again. I'm going to say some things that some people might deem controversial, but whatever. The lockdowns are a luxury of the rich. If you have money, you can survive a lockdown. If you don't, you have to fight and barely get by. Every metric we have for a declining society is up. Every metric. Because of these lockdowns, 150 million more people worldwide will go into extreme poverty. 150 million people worldwide, because we decided to shut off global supply chains, shut off the movement of people, goods, and services. 15,000 scientists just signed the Barrington Declaration that said the lockdowns are the greatest threat to human health. They say it's all about safety and health. The lockdowns are hurting people. These are not victimless crimes. We tried to kill a mouse with a missile, and we did not adapt as we moved on. The more we saw the data come in, the more we locked down our country. All it did is delay the inevitable and also harm our young people. One out of four of young people contemplated suicide in our country the last 90 days. One out of four. Antidepressant medication is up 600% in our country. 600%. I can go through the numbers. 40% of U.S. adults reported struggling with mental health, up from 6% last year. U.S. Army suicides have increased 30% during the pandemic compared to 2019. The CDC, because of concerns about the Chinese coronavirus, estimated 41% of U.S. adults had delayed urgent medical care. They didn't want to go to the hospital. They thought they were going to get hurt. How about small businesses? Yelp, which all of you have used, say that 60% of their restaurants on their app will never reopen. 60%. Who owns small businesses? Who owns these restaurants? All of you guys out here. You guys know how hard it is. You have to deal with the city, the local, the county government, convince people to come back in. The backbone of the American entrepreneurial experiment are middle-class people taking a small risk that have 5 to 10 employees, and we crushed them. And what happened to the ruling class in this country? Jeff Bezos is richer than he ever has been. The wealthy and the rich, God bless them, most of which have been able to survive this quite well. It is the collectivist class that has been calling the shots in this country that hurt the little guy through these lockdowns. And they say, well, it's to stop the spread. That's a lie. Never would you ever be able to stop the spread. You're just delaying the inevitable. You could temporarily slow it. You could temporarily stunt it. But it gave people false confidence in something that actually hurt real human beings. And how about our generation? As I mentioned, 52% of my generation is now living at home with their parents, up from 37% last year. 52%. Again, I'm not trying to attack people that are living at home with their parents. Some people have no choice. They have no financial choice. So we have a generation that the average student loan debt per borrower is $31,000 per borrower that then graduates college with very little to any skill most times. And I'm happy to build out the whole college issue to then enter a country where we tell them, just go work harder. Go work harder. Oh, I'm sorry, we shut down the country the last 9 months. And what we are playing with right now in Western society, if we do not fully reopen our economies and fully reopen our schools, will be irreparable damage to the backbone of our republic that will only give license to a socialist demagogue to get power. The kind of intractable problems that we are starting to see pop up will pave the way in the next 18 months, next 2 years, for a younger version of Bernie Sanders to take power in our country, the likes of which we have never seen. Because we wanted to allegedly protect health. We wanted to do the right thing for safety and health. And so what's really amazing to me about the whole lockdown issue is how we tolerated the incredible and blatant hypocrisy of the people that were putting forth these orders. There are orders that say churches cannot open, yet BLM Incorporated is allowed to parade through the streets, no masks, no social distancing, all throughout the streets of our country. Los Angeles Lakers celebration drew 15,000 people in the streets of LA, but if you have 25 people in your church, you risk total and complete arrest. What was really the most telling moment of the last 6 to 9 months of these lockdowns is something that is not a happy conclusion. Human beings don't want to be free. We don't. Human beings, and I think JD said this, it was really well said, security, satisfaction, and significance. That's what human beings want. If you do not teach freedom to your young people and what it means, they won't demand it. I have been incredibly let down by the lack of backlash from what we have done to ourselves the last 6 months. Now, maybe there's going to be a pent-up backlash in the election. I pray. Maybe people are going to use this opportunity to vote, to express their values this way. But the 210,000 small businesses that have gone under in the last 6 months, they're gone. They'll never open again. In the state of California, we've lost more people to suicide than to the virus under the age of 35. Suicide is up 200% in 6 counties in Tennessee, and most states will not publish their suicide data. Most states are actually hiding their suicide data because it's so bad. And just out of all the information we've been able to find, it is extraordinary. So what do we do about it? Well, first you have to admit we made a mistake. We did. And the next time people that make open-ended declarative statements saying to trust the science, we should be very, very skeptical of these people, because the left, they say trust the science. It's not true. They want to trust the scientists that they like, because there were plenty of scientists and doctors that were speaking out throughout this entire thing. And so what does this mean for where we are in America? I want anyone over the age of 40 to think back where you were in your mid-20s. You were working hard, hopefully, earning wealth, hopefully seeing your life get a little materially better each year. As you were seeing your life get a little materially better, you were gaining faith in the American system. You were believing that if you worked hard and play by the rules, the system works for you. An average 27-year-old in this country, if they graduate college, which only 59% of people that go to college graduate, the national graduation rate is 59%, so 41% that go to college drop out, 41%. If they graduate, they have an average $37,000 per bar, $32,000 to $37,000, depending on the region. They graduate sometimes with a degree that has no application to the marketplace whatsoever. And we stuff them into urban cities with a very, very high cost of living, where they are not building equity and they're not taking out mortgages. This is a generation that is the least likely to own property of any generation in American history. It is the least married generation in American history. We're on pace to have 500,000 less children next year than this year. We're on the verge of a civilizational collapse and no one wants to talk about it. 500,000 less children. They're worried about overpopulation. I'm worried about a civilizational collapse. And all of a sudden they're in Seattle and Portland and their net worth is the same as when they're 28, as when they're 32, because 44% of college graduates in this country end up getting jobs that don't require a college degree. So the question is, why'd they go at all? I don't know. I have certain guesses on that. We can talk about that. But then don't be surprised when the 32-year-old who's unmarried, doesn't have a mortgage and $37,000 in debt and is working a minimum wage job, all of a sudden thinks that the entire system does not work for them. And that's exactly what's happening in our country that no one wants to talk about, is that the burning and the rioting and the looting, BLM Inc. is just a manifestation of economic anxiety held by a lot of middle-class young people in this country. And Bernie Sanders had a complete and total incorrect application of what we're supposed to do about this. However, he wasn't wrong in the observation. He wasn't. When you have a generation that is the most indebted, most urbanized generation in American history, where they're renting, not owning, where they're not marrying, eventually that is a combustible group of people that is waiting for a revolution. So what do we do about that? We have to give young people the confidence in the American way of life. That's what we have to do. We have to get them to buy into this system again. And that means ownership. That means marriage. That means responsibility. And that also means we need a lot less people going to college in our country. A lot. We have way too many people going to college. We need more carpenters, welders, HVAC, police officers, firefighters, entrepreneurs, gap year, people that work with their hands, than people that go to four-year universities to borrow money they don't have, to study things that don't matter, to find jobs that don't exist. And I understand, I say the same thing here that I'll say, and I know that when you go to Highland Park, Texas, you do not touch the third rail of politics, which is higher education, but I'm going right in. Because, and I'm not, I think college is wonderful if you want to be a lawyer, a doctor, if you want to get a skill. We interview thousands of young people at Turning Point USA every single year. My favorite question to ask is, what is your skill? And sometimes they'll say, well, I went to TCU and I have political science degree. I said, no, what's your skill? And they said, I took all these classes. I said, no, what can you do that my Turning Point USA leaders at Highland Park High School can't do? Well, I took all these classes. I said, I got that. But what's your skill? Now, when I hire a plumber, they come to the office, I have a leak, they say, I can fix that. I say, you have a skill that they don't have and I don't have. You're hired. What's happened is that we have convinced ourselves that college is a necessary track towards success in this country. And it's not. It is for some people, but the obligatory path to go to four-year university in this college and in this environment has led to many of the problems that we're experiencing today. We need a lot more people to go to community college. We need a lot more people to take gap years. We need a lot more people that maybe go get a technical degree and they don't go to university at all. And the other part of this, and all of you know this, is if you send your kid to college, you're playing Russian roulette with their values. And they may come back someone completely and totally different. Now, if they survive, God bless America, right? But where do you think the defund police, Green New Deal, where do you think these ideas originate from? What happens on college campuses did not stay on college campuses. It goes to the Hall of Congress and eventually corporate boardrooms. And I think that, and I grew up in this kind of environment in the suburbs of Chicago, there's an expectation that our most aspirational, the most qualified young people must go to four-year university. And for some people, that is the right path, but not for every person. And I think we should ask our high school seniors, why are you going to college, not where are you going to college? We need better reasons to go $80,000 into debt. We need better reasons to go take North African lesbian poetry. We need better reasons to go find yourself at a university. Because, believe it or not, you can learn a lot outside of college. In fact, I can tell you that I think things are finally being disrupted on this landscape. And if I were trying to create a population of people that was ripe for a socialistic revolution, I would send them all to a place that they can't afford, to believe in nothing, to be ungrateful for a country they live in, to acquire no skill, to stuff them into urban areas they can't afford, to be ready to be convinced for someone that will give a lot of promises to fix all of that, but will never deliver. Now, I'm not saying it's all intentional, but if I was trying to do this, this is exactly what I would do. And so what do we do? Well, we talk about this quite often. We need to dramatically expand the birth rate for people under the age of 35 in this country. We need to make it easier to have children. I'm a conservative and I believe in paid family leave. I do. I think that we need to make it easier to have children in this country. It's too expensive to have children in America. And the birth rates in America are so incredibly alarming that if we do not, 500,000 less children next year should be a fire alarm for our civilization. Also, I think that we need to teach our children, and this kind of ties back to what I started with, that we don't live in an awful country. Because I think when I grew up in the 1990s and early 2000s, my parents always used to tell me that I was the problem and America was awesome. Now we tell our young people that you're awesome and America's the problem. And what higher education should be, but it isn't, is teasing young people that maybe there is truth and goodness out there. And let's go on a journey together to try and find it. Let's read the great books. Let's hear from the great lecturers. Let's dive deep into history, and maybe we can find truth, beauty, and goodness. What happens at almost every university across the country is the exact opposite, is they say there is no such thing as absolute truth. Beauty is something that is completely subjective, and I'm going to teach you how to become an expert complainer. We create a nation of victims, not victors, and you can see exactly where that ends. I want to take some questions, but also I want to end with kind of the election. A lot of you have questions about the election and where things are headed. Early voting looks very good for Republicans and President Trump, and I can dive into some of those numbers if you're interested. However, outside of the election, and you guys know this, Texas is in play, all these sorts of things, but why is Texas in play? And it's not because of Californians. Actually, Californians are voting more Republican than Democrat, according to the recent data that I've seen. So you can thank California for one good export, finally, right? And the reason is cultural, and I think we all know this, that as conservatives and Republicans might have been winning elections for the last 30 years, we've been losing almost every single cultural battle and every cultural institution. How we educate our children. How we communicate our values. Are we creating a more thankful generation that is more likely to appreciate this beautiful gift? So people say we're divided. I agree. We are divided. I think we're divided in two categories in our country. Those people that are thankful that they live in America, and those people that are angry that they live in America. I think that's the true division. As I've mentioned, we made plenty of mistakes as a country, but we are not a mistake. If you apply yourself correctly, you can truly succeed in America. And the thing that really depresses me the most is when I meet a young person that has been convinced that their action has no bearing on their future in the country. That no matter what they do, they are not able to succeed. And more so than anything else, our future rests, I think, solely on our ability to make our kids love America again. That we are the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. That we have done so much good for the planet and for the world. And that if we are able to communicate these values and these ideas to young people, then that will be the future of America outside of the election. The election is just a moment in time. And I do think things are trending positively and we can build that out even more. Benjamin Franklin famously said, it's a republic if you can keep it. So it's all on us and everyone here to do exactly that. So let's do some questions. And I want to thank you. What an unbelievable turnout, especially young people. So I want to thank you guys for that. And we'll do some questions.
Charlie, can you talk a little bit about globalism versus nationalism, why Trump ran for president, what he's actually fighting against? He's fighting a lot bigger battles than just what's going on in this country.
Yeah, I mean, there is a push to destroy American sovereignty. There is a push to try to create a almost unified world government that will basically deteriorate the idea of the United States of America as its own self-determining country. And President Donald Trump stands in stark opposition to a lot of these needs, wants, and wishes of a lot of these people that are pushing for this. And so you can see this in the push for the Paris Climate Accord, which would have destroyed the oil and gas industry in this state if fully implemented. You see this in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You see this through the overzealous push to try to have the United Nations almost have jurisdiction over our country. And I'm a believer in countries being able to determine their own future. And there is an understandable, I think there's an understandable school of thought that says, well, in the 20th century, we had too many individual nations and look how badly that ended. I say, hold on a second. How many people died because the Soviet Union tried to create a global empire? See, we don't teach communism correctly in our country, that the Soviet Union was exporting communism to every single continent. It was the only export that ended up being affected out of the Soviet Union. Rhodesia turned to Zimbabwe. Cuba got taken over by Fidel Castro. Venezuela was once a beautiful, unbelievably rich and prosperous country and flipped in a generation. We have tried countries with global ambitions before and trying to unify the entire planet under one perspective. And it is very, very dangerous what one of these people are pushing. Look, the president gets a bad rap, and I think a lot of it, almost all of it, is completely unwarranted. And this is a president who did not have to run for office. This is a man that, despite the ridicule, the backlash, and the opposition, not only won the election in 2016, but he did something that is against the golden rule of Washington, D.C. He actually did what he said he was going to do after he got elected. And I understand some of you say, I don't like his tweets. I don't like his style. Okay. Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, 200 federal judges, soon to be 300, largest middle class tax cut, finally taking child sex trafficking seriously in our country, canceling the Iran deal, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing Golan Heights. And I think we have to be very clear as to what is the, who is the president and what time are we in? There's a season for everything. The Bible tells us this. And I believe that we're in a season of struggle. We're in a season of conflict. You might not have signed up for this, but nations go through this periodically. And when you're in a season of struggle and conflict, you want to make sure that the ideas that preserve the civilization you care about win. And that's why I said at my RNC speech that President Donald Trump is the bodyguard of Western civilization. And I love that imagery of a bodyguard, because when I hire a bodyguard, I couldn't care less about their tweet history. I don't care about if they're a little rough around the edges. I want someone that knows how to fight and will protect our country and our civilization. And quite honestly, for the first time in my lifetime, I finally feel that we are making tangible and serious policy wins for the betterment of our country under a conservative perspective. I mentioned the judge, I mentioned all these sorts of things. And And then you look at the alternative. You look at the alternative, the Harris administration, because that's who really will be in charge. The Harris administration will pack the courts, make D.C. and Puerto Rico states. They will abolish the Electoral College. And they look at that opportunity to weaponize the entire federal government in their image. And so, yeah, the stakes are really high. And I think that's why a lot of you are showing up tonight. I think the unspoken thing that's happening here is that you feel like you're losing your country, and you're right, because we are. You're losing the country. You're losing our country to people that suddenly have an extraordinary amount of power, and they're willing to use it. And the one thing that the corporate elites and the big tech elites and the Hollywood community and all these people, the one thing that frustrates them so much is that they still can't control all of you. The one thing that bothers them is they think that they can bully and intimidate and almost extort all of you to vote for Joe Biden. They say it so plainly. The most factual thing that Joe Biden said over the summer was that if you elect me, the riots will stop. I believe that. I do. I think that he would make a couple phone calls and he'd say, end it. I think that the manufactured chaos that we saw in our country the last couple months was trying to get people to say, I've had enough. Who's going to try to end this sort of stuff? But I think the American people are a lot wiser than that. I think that our government is set up. Of course, the people are the sovereign in our country. We, the people, such an incredible leap forward for humanity that some king or queen or blood right is not in charge, but you actually get to call the shots. And that's the only thing they still have not yet been able to control. And that's what he represents. And that's why they hate him so much. So great question. Let's get a question here. And all my political remarks are made on behalf of Turning Point Action, not Turning Point USA. We have a C3 and a C4. And those of you that deal in that world know exactly why I have to say that. So yes, next question.
Hi, Charlie. You brought up paid leave earlier. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how a free market...
Brought up what? I'm sorry.
Paid leave.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit more about that and how a free market capitalist can tackle that conversation?
Sure. Well, I think that the family is the bedrock of any functioning society. I think that it is a disgrace that 77% of Black babies in this country are born without a stable father in the home. I think that the number one reason why mothers do not have more than one or two kids, which is the average birth rate for natural born Americans, is because of financial reasons. And I don't think we have a capitalist system if you don't have a country. And I also believe that if we do not prioritize the family and family creation in our country, then you're not going to have a country to even have a capitalist system at all. And I actually value the family more than I value, I value family creation and stable families more so than I might value like the maximal profit return. And we spend money on such ridiculous garbage in this country. And there's conservative ways to fund it. President Trump put forth a conservative way to do it, said you can borrow out of your Social Security fund and be able to do this. And look, it's a provocative view for a conservative to hold. Some people disagree with it. But if we're serious about the civilizational collapse that we're looking at right now, and we want to actually fix some of these problems, and we know this through psychological data, we know this, we should want young families to have more children, and we should want mothers to be able to spend those formative years with their newborns. We should want that. So, for example, in the 1980s, it required 35 weeks of work to earn about $75,000 a year. Now it requires 53 weeks of work. What does that mean? It almost forces the woman into the workplace. Now, I'm not diametrically against that if the woman chooses, but I am against it by force. I think it's bad that young women in this country, young mothers, have no other option but to go into the marketplace to keep a middle-class lifestyle going. And so, yeah, that's why I think that if we're serious about the role the family plays in the American society, which we know is the longest-lasting, most important institution to any functioning civilization, then we must make it easier to have children in this country. We also must, I think, support young mothers being with those children. And every single study shows that if a young mother is able to be with a newborn for those 18 months, they're far less likely to go to prison, far less likely to commit suicide, they're less likely to be social isolation. Every metric that we are concerned about comes back to the mother being there with the baby the first 18 to 24 months. And yes, it is a financial obstacle. It is. And so I could defend it from a conservative position and just an American position. How we fund it, how we do it, I don't know. But I think that given the circumstance that we're in, it is the right thing for our country. So thank you. I appreciate the question. So. Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Welcome to Dallas, Charlie.
Thank you.
My name is Chad Jackson. I'm actually from the film Uncle Tom, which was released.
Oh, it's earlier. One of my favorite.
We actually have more of our team here tonight, too. So welcome to Dallas.
Everyone's got to check out this film. It's incredible.
So what does a Joe Biden win mean for America in 2020? And how do you recommend Turning Point and other conservative groups across the country engage in the fight in the 4 years after that? So thank you.
So if he wins, it also depends on whether he takes the Senate. So let's just go total apocalyptic, cataclysmic, he wins everything, okay? What then? Well, I can tell you what I'm going to do. We're going to get up and go to work and do two podcasts a day and do our radio show and keep on traveling to campuses. We're not going to give up. That's the first thing. And I want to make sure that we all of a sudden do not become completely despondent if that happens. Now, so just talking about what I said earlier, I don't want to get people's hopes up too much, but just because it's the early voting numbers we're seeing out of these states, we've never seen before for Republicans. We've never seen it. We have never seen Republicans vote early in this kind of numbers and this kind of enthusiasm ever in the history of our elections. It's unbelievable. So now, There's two potential explanations for this. One is that our base is fired up and we're going to fizzle out. Okay. Or it can be a quick start and we sustain it and we build it and then we also crush on election day. So I don't know which one it will be, but a vote is a vote. Whether you vote on election day or vote early, the fact we're voting early is awesome. That just lessens the amount of people that we have to actually focus on to get them to show up and to persuade them. And so it's a very, very good thing. And there's also others, like kind of little crumbs, to use a Nancy Pelosi term, that I think is very positive for President Trump. We sold 19 million guns in this country in the last 9 months. I don't think that's a lot of Joe Biden voters, okay? I think there is so much pent-up disgust against these lockdowns, against the double standard, against the micro tyranny. I think that people are just, they cannot wait to go vote. It's an enthusiasm level that makes 2016 look like nothing. So the question is this, and this is a very real question. Is there also a hidden anti-Trump vote? Are there also people out there that have been waiting for the chance to vote against him? And they don't have a chance to go to rallies, and their rallies are like the BLM demonstrations. And the answer is maybe. I am less convinced that you can make people show up in the same numbers against a candidate that you can for a candidate. That is why recall efforts rarely work in this country. It is very, very hard to mobilize people on a referendum. It's not impossible. We're going to see if they can do it because no one is actually voting for Joe Biden. That person does not exist. Those Biden-Harris signs, okay? Those Biden-Harris signs over here, those are not actual Biden-Harris signs, okay? Those are, I hate Donald Trump, and I'm such a good person, look at me signs, okay? So, and that's really what that says. So, here's the other good news for Trump, if you guys want it. If you're still undecided right now, and if you're here tonight, thank you for coming. But if you're still undecided, and you still, after everything they've thrown at Trump, you're like, I don't know if I don't like this Trump guy. You're waiting for a reason to vote for Trump. Let's just be honest, okay? After the nonstop 24/7 just arbitrage that this guy has had to survive, it is the people are just saying, like, please give me a reason to vote for you. Huge debate on Thursday. Massive. The president has to win this debate. If he wins the debate, I'm convinced he wins the election. It's that simple. I think if the president comes out, he has to do three things. And I did a whole podcast on this, but I'll distill them into three quick things. Number one, I think that he has to handle the Hunter Biden thing correctly. I think he runs a risk of handling this thing completely in the wrong direction. If he focuses too much on Hunter and too much on conjecture, he'll lose that argument. He has to make it about Joe, not about Hunter. If you make it too much about Hunter, Hunter's not running for office, okay? Joe Biden and Kamala Harris is. Instead, you have to say, Joe, why do you refuse not to answer these questions? He just has to ask the question, demonstrate the facts, and let Joe talk. Number two, in a very bizarre way, the debate commission, I think, has given Trump an advantage here. President Trump has to not interrupt Joe Biden, okay? He just, well, his microphone will be muted, so I guess that will help. And again, it's just, if we're just going to be very honest, independent swing voters do not like a candidate that's interrupting the other person. They don't. So he's got to not do that. I don't think he has much of a choice. And then the third thing that he has to do is he has to be happier, more positive, and smile more than Joe Biden. People are waiting to be happy again. Like, I've never seen a desire to be happy as much as I've seen in our country. And so the entire Biden campaign is the most depressing line of political argumentation I've ever seen. Everyone's dying. It's all awful. We wear a mask when we shower. It's like, it's awful, right? I mean, we're going to shut everything down. And so President Trump, and I think he has an humble, and I just mean this as aesthetically as I can make, he has a great smile. He has a great way to himself. I think that if he channels the energy he had with Savannah Guthrie last week, where he's magnanimous and he's charming, he wins the election so convincingly, it won't even be close. Now, if he has another one of the shouting matches, I don't know what's going to happen. But he has a chance right now. I'd rather be President Trump than Joe Biden. If you said, Charlie, who would you rather be at this point in this time? I'd rather be the candidate that has the most new registered voters, which President Trump has an advantage of hundreds of thousands of newly registered voters. I want the candidate that's crushing early voting, which typically wins on election day. I want the candidate that's not mired in an FBI scandal about intercontinentally selling out our country. I want the candidate with a stronger base, and I want the candidate that actually does public appearances. So that's President Trump. Like, I would take that in a second, where, and I know that might not, there is evidence to show that maybe Joe Biden will have some other support or some things that'll surge at the end. But if President Trump does his job, it's his race to win or lose. It's that simple. It's completely in his hands and also your hands. We'll talk about that. Let's get to the next question.
Could you talk about the prevalence of cancel culture and how it affects civil discourse and public policy?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most dangerous things happening in our country right now, that the people with the most amount of power in America, they seek to silence, destroy, and annihilate anyone they disagree with. And we were a country for many years where we could agree to disagree. It is a bedrock American principle that the minority opinion should be given a platform. And we are now entering a phase of America, if not directly confronted, where if you dare say something that is not the dogmatic opinion, you will lose your job, lose your friends, be socially isolated, outcast. And that's already happening. 71% of young people are afraid to express their religious and political views. Now, that's a really, really alarming poll. Equally, I can't imagine all of them are Democrats. So I think there's a lot more young people that believe what we believe. They're just afraid to say it. And I think it's going to be reflected in a lot of the voting numbers that'll surprise a lot of people. But the number one form of censorship, though, in this country is self-censorship. It's people shutting themselves up because they're afraid of somebody saying something at the grocery store. You're less likely to wear the MAGA hat. You're less likely to wear, you know, the God is real t-shirt, whatever it might be. You're less likely to wear the Trump pin or the Trump button. And so one out of five of college students believe that using physical force against opposing viewpoints is okay. One out of five. And so it shouldn't stun you when all of a sudden people take to the streets like they did this weekend and they assault the black conservative in the streets of San Francisco and they assault that young woman who's a Turning Point USA ambassador, Isabel, at the Women's March. They hospitalize her and nearly break her neck just because she was holding up a Trump flag. And I say this with no joking at all. Our Turning Point USA college students, we go through training on how they should do their advocacy to not get hospitalized, right? Because if you do it incorrectly in the wrong places on the wrong campus, you will get physically beaten. And there's very little back, there's very little recourse for that. And so, yeah, it's as bad as you could possibly imagine. It's worse. And so what's the solution to this? Is that anyone who dares cancel somebody because it's an opinion they don't like, they must be harshly held accountable. If it's a college administrator, if it's a boss, if it's a CEO. And the other thing is that enough people have to say, I'm not going to abide by the cancellation standards that you put through. I mean, they're trying to cancel Chris Pratt now because he's a Christian. I mean, it's a whole new thing they're doing in Hollywood the last couple of days. And just because he came out as a Christian and some other celebrity's like, oh, he hates gay people because he's a Christian. I mean, just completely baseless. And so there's only two ways to govern human beings. You can govern human beings by speaking, persuasion, and talking, or you can govern human beings by force. The American experiment has succeeded because we have had a system where you have to make good arguments to get power and continue to earn people's trust to stay in power. The other government systems the last 100 years were based on force. The Soviet Union, Communist China, Cuba. They don't make arguments, they just take power. So if all of a sudden, if you shut people's capacity to speak, you're heading to a very, very dangerous direction. Which, by the way, that's why what we are doing at Turning Point USA is so critical to the fabric of the republic. Because many of these campuses, Highland Park High School, all these campuses, there's no conservative presence at all whatsoever. Where if all of a sudden they are able to obliterate all viewpoints or all opinions of a certain political opinion, then they've won completely. And then you've entered a one-party state. So it's a very good question. I appreciate it. Thank you. Next question.
Hi. I believe in strong borders and that it's very important to come in legally, but an argument that I often run into is, what about the people who can't afford to come in legally or need to come into the country quickly because they're in a dangerous situation?
It's a great question. Thank you for being here tonight. It's great. So, look, immigration should always benefit the country that you live in. I mean, this idea that we have completely blurred the lines of what immigration is in our country. And mind you, we are the most benevolent country when it comes to immigration on the planet. You know that we take in half of the world's immigrants every single year? Half. We're 5% of the world's population, yet we take in half the world's immigrants. That's legal. That doesn't even count illegal border crossings or, you know, illegal entries into the country. And so if you can't afford to come into this country legally, there's plenty of ways to still, you can apply for a green card and all these sorts of things. But I'm of the opinion that every immigration proposal and policy must be kept in mind with, is it good for our country? Are these people able to assimilate into our country? Because it should always be about assimilation of the American culture. And if not, then sometimes you should take pauses with American immigration. And we've done this in our past before very successfully. And this new idea of bringing 1.2 million people into our country endlessly is a failed model. It's not working. And that's where you have more people that speak Spanish than English in the state of California. I'm not against speaking Spanish, but if you do not have the capacity to interface, if you do not have a common language, which I believe English should be the official language of the United States, then you've lost a lot of the capacity to be able to relate with people and communicate with people. And so, and as far as asylum seekers, we are the most generous country when it comes to asylum seekers. It's not even close. I mean, Japan took one person last year as an asylum seeker, okay? One. I mean, why even do the one, right? That's why it's like, and so we take tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people when it comes to that. And so this is why I believe in very strong borders on the southern border, because not only is it bad with all the reasons that you obviously agree with, which is the crime, the child sex trafficking, the drugs, but also what it does is it diminishes legal immigration is what it does. And it blurs the line between the person in Bulgaria and Belarus that has to wait their turn for 20 years to come into America, and then someone that's able to come to the southern border and hop in. That is not, that is a moral difference of immigration. I never think we should blur those lines between someone that comes here the right way and immigrates and someone that comes in illegally. So thank you for your question. I appreciate it. Next question.
Hey, Charlie, just before my question, I just want to let you know how much I appreciate and how refreshing it is having such a young person like you be such a political trailblazer in this country right
now. Thank you. Thank you.
My question is, what are your thoughts on the whole Hunter Biden hard drive situation, and how do you think that is going to possibly affect the election here in the next couple weeks?
It's a great question. It's probably the greatest argument not to do crack cocaine that I've ever seen. I mean, So anyone that's in kind of like the drug rehabilitation world, you can use this. I mean, your father's running for the presidency of the United States, and you show up with three laptops, one of which that has emails and text messages with foreign oligarchs, and you forget to pick them up. At first, that was apprehensive and skeptical. Now we have evidence that shows that his signature verified that he did this. We have the person, Del Isaac, I think is his name, of the computer repair shop that has shown that this is exactly what happened. But I'm skeptical. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has had this laptop for 9 months and they've done nothing, because there really are two justice systems in this country, one for the wealthy Democrats that are well-connected and for the rest of us. And secondly, I don't know if we have enough time to really make this move the dial, but we don't need to make it move the dial 10 points. If this is able to move the dial 2 or 3 points, then this can have a very significant advantage for President Trump, especially in the state of Pennsylvania, especially in a state where Joe Biden pretends he's the good old Scranton guy. Okay, you're the good old Scranton guy when you're sending your crack addicted son to Kazakhstan, China, Ukraine to sit on Burisma while you make millions of dollars for 10% for the big man. That dog does not hunt in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Let me tell you that. And so I don't know what the implications will be, but just so if you have no idea what we're talking about, the Hunter Biden thing, it's worse than you can imagine. I encourage you to look at these emails. They have been independently authenticated. They have been verified and corroborated through metadata and other ways. And the most scary thing, though, out of the entire Hunter Biden story is not the Hunter Biden story. It's not. It's how the most valuable companies in our country that are worth trillions of dollars have decided that you do not have the right to read this story. That should horrify you. Because when you have multi-trillion dollar companies collectively with their market cap together, all of a sudden say, no, 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 citizen, you're not supposed to see this. That makes 1984 look like an instruction manual, where you have a one-party state that is saying that you are not allowed to view it. And if you don't know what happened, I'll just say this. New York Post article against Hunter Biden last week, Twitter and Facebook forbade the sharing, the direct messaging, and the viewing of their articles on their platform, and they would deactivate your Twitter account. My Twitter account was deactivated over the weekend for a similar violation. I just got my Twitter account back today. And so what's really scary, though, and this is something that I think we all have, it's a teaching moment. We as conservatives have always thought of corporations as being on our side. We've always thought of the biggest companies to be on Team Republican. That is not the case anymore. These tech companies in particular, Facebook, Google, Twitter, all of them, they view themselves as auxiliary communication and enforcement arms of the Democrat Party. And they are, in my opinion, that's when you should lose your Section 230 immunity. People should be able to sue these companies, and because it is not fair. And I want to be clear, it's not a free market when it comes to these tech companies. We gave them a government-provided protection where we can't sue them. So it's worse than that. People say, well, why didn't we regulate them? No, it's worse than that. We gave them a regulation that protected their incumbency. We gave them a government favor to be able to act like a publisher while saying they're a platform. So you asked about Hunter Biden. The Hunter Biden thing, we'll see how it shakes out. We're going to keep talking about it. But the thing that I want all of you guys to really think about over the next couple of days and weeks heading into the election and post-election, is it okay that a couple of companies have more power than our federal government? Because here's the thing. If the federal government came out and they said, you're not allowed to read the New York Post story, we would sue and we'd win in court in an afternoon, because we have a First Amendment for that. If the federal government all of a sudden deleted a social media account of yours, you'd say, you're not allowed to do that. That is a violation of my First Amendment rights. There's no Bill of Rights with these tech companies. We have no rights. So we're dealing in a digital age, in an ecosystem that's created for these tech companies, staffed only by people that agree with one viewpoint, that we're bad and they're smart and good, and just give them power and they're going to figure it out for us. They're the philosopher kings, as Plato would say. That's horrifying. And so it's long past time for action against that. That's the real thing. And you know what also tells me? The tech companies wouldn't have done this if this Hunter Biden story wasn't legit. These tech companies would not have done this if this Hunter Biden story was just like vapor and fake. There's something to this story that has them so nervous, and it actually created the Barbara Streisand effect. The Barbara Streisand effect in 2003, Barbara Streisand, pictures of her Malibu home started to be leaked, and she said, no. She tried to buy all these pictures back, and it resulted in millions of people going to go look at her home, and more people knew where she lived than if she would have just let the pictures be released anyway. It's exactly what happened to Hunter Biden. It became a bigger story than they would have ever possibly imagined. And so it's a great question. Thank you. Next.
So I want to go back to the college question. What are your, I'm curious, your thoughts on the value or lack thereof of a liberal arts education? To give some background on where I'm coming from, I graduated in 2014 with a degree in music. I've now got a job as a software developer, self-taught through online resources, graduated with zero debt. So, you know, obviously graduating, I was like, gosh, I wish I could do something useful. But looking back on it, I don't regret that.
Where did you go to school?
Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee.
I know it very well.
Yeah.
You survived. You're not a communist, right? Good. So it worked for you. It's great. No debt. Financially worked. And you were able to not be indoctrinated. I wish liberal arts was the idea of liberal arts. And maybe you had a different experience at Belmont. And I've heard mixed things about Belmont. We were talking about that earlier with somebody, where they have a whole thing where they don't want Donald Trump on their campus this week because he's coming to debate. My opinion of liberal arts is that in its ideal form, it's terrific. But the current state of liberal arts in this country, I'm a very, very harsh critic of, where you are reading more Angela Davis or Herbert Marcuse and Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida than Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas, you got a problem. And so if liberal arts is able to refashion its roots as being a traditional classical Western education, I am all for that. If it can be done so, in your case, economically, makes sense, not going endlessly into debt. But you also kind of proved my point. You got a music degree and now you're a software engineer, right? So awesome, but it didn't really give you a skill. It might have given you a good worldview, right? And you were able to survive and do that, and that's a good thing. So my incumbent position is I'm a critic of current liberal arts education. I am. Because I've seen what it creates, and I've seen the lack of depth at many of these universities of what they're teaching and what they're expressing and the venom that some of these professors have. And if Belmont's the exception, God bless Belmont. I know a little bit about the school, but, you know, not enough to be able to interface on that. But hope that helps answer your question. So thank you. Next question.
Hi, Charlie. My name is Patrick, and my question is about healthcare. I was just curious to get your opinion because I know that you've been a very vocal critic of socialized medicine as well. You should be.
Yes.
However, what are the conservative alternatives? What specific policies should we as conservatives be trying to advocate for and implement to build a better healthcare system in America?
It's a phenomenal question. Thank you. Part of believing in a market, according to Milton Friedman, one of the most important things in believing in a market is prices. Prices is how you communicate with the vendor or the entrepreneur or the provider what you are willing to pay or give up for what they're offering. The biggest problem with healthcare in this country, especially at the delivery point, is the lack of prices, is the surprise billing, is the disclosure of prices. This is why the president passing an executive order by our friend Cynthia Fisher, it was terrific, for healthcare transparency, that hospitals have to publish their prices to people that go into hospitals. And I believe this is a free market position. I do. Because I believe the more information you give the patient, the better decisions they'll be able to make. I also believe firmly in buying health insurance across state lines. I believe in tort reform, which is something I think that Texas has done very well. I believe that we need more independent practice doctors in this country and less conglomerate, massive hospital organizations. But more than anything else, I think where conservatives get wrong on this issue is sometimes they become defenders of a broken incumbent position, of broken incumbent system. I think because some Republicans are heavily funded by these organizations, they're heavily funded by some of these companies, and they go out of their way to defend a system that really in some ways works and other ways doesn't. And so if we're trying to create a healthcare system, in my opinion, that works, we definitely don't want the Bernie Sanders model, nationalize everything, it's a disaster. But we also should appreciate what we do right. We have the highest quality of care on the planet. We have more innovations. It's just the problem is it's really expensive, hard to be able to get high accessibility for it. And there's a lot of problems in the middle area of Medicaid, health insurance, and health insurance for the poor, which is Medicaid, and also employer-provided health care. So I think the first step for Republicans on health care has to be the more information, the better. We have to become transparency crusaders, where we want you to have all the information. When you break a leg, exactly what they're going to give you and what that is going to mean for you on your health insurance plan. The more questioning, the more conversation, the more communication with patients when it comes to healthcare, I believe the better. And I think that's a free market position that I'd be willing to defend. Happy to dive into it more, but we'll kind of leave it there. Thank you. Appreciate it. Next question.
Hi, my name is Ava from the Highland Park Turning Point.
Thank you
chapter.
For being here tonight. It's
yes,
awesome.
We're so excited. And I was wondering if you could talk about where you draw the line with free speech, hate speech, and slander.
It's a terrific question. My position is that even hate speech should be completely and totally allowed in our country. The most disgusting speech should absolutely be protected. And it's not a viewpoint that is held by the left. The ACLU used to hold this viewpoint. The American Civil Liberties Union, they sued so that legitimate Nazis could march through downtown Skokie. You remember this? Back in the 80s and 90s? Now, why would the ACLU do this? Because they said, as soon as you use the word hate, that is a very subjective term. Because then all of a sudden it is in the eyes or it is in the implementation of whomever has the power. So here's my belief. The more speech, the better. Let's use the Westboro Baptist Church, for example. So there's a movement that says it should be illegal to say what they're saying. I think what they say is disgusting. I think what they say is reprehensible. But I've also seen every time they show up, a multiple of people show up peacefully to show how foolish they are. I think that in a civil society, the best ideas will win as long as you have that marketplace. And here's the real issue. As soon as you shut up hate speech, those people only get more powerful. And this is the unintended consequence of censorship. You give more credence to the silenced person the moment you shut them up, because then they can play the victim and they say, they're trying to shut me up because I have something that everyone else wants. And I'm a threat to them. No, you're not. You're just a fool. And those people have too much power. And so the minute that you start to enforce speech laws like they do in Europe based on specific political opinions, regardless of how reprehensible they are, then you actually give credence to them. This is why in Germany, where they do not allow swastikas, they do not allow Nazi paraphernalia, their white nationalist awful movement is actually gaining traction because it has like a rebellious underbelly. No. Let me be very clear. Bring your bad ideas publicly so decent people can cross-examine you, so we can see who you are, we can talk to you, and convince the public otherwise. This is a hard argument for some young people to hear, because they're like, it's so hateful, it's so awful, it deteriorates our country. No. Those ideas, if they spread, deteriorate our country. But good people will speak in opposition to them. And that's why I'm a free speech absolutist, through and through. I think that the utility of speech is what makes human beings different than any other type of being on the planet. Aristotle said we are the speaking beings, that our capacity to communicate is who we are. And I actually think it creates an act of citizenry when bad people are allowed to speak. When really bad people are given a permit, all of a sudden the entire population's like, that's disgusting. Let's go get our yard signs, go make them, and we're going to go speak out against them. They're kind of on their toes. They're looking out for things. All of a sudden, if the government becomes the speech police and they start calling the shots, like, oh, the government will get rid of the bad guys for me. And they kind of become complacent. They become less active. They become less responsible for the country around them. And so I don't draw a line. That's me. I say that you should allow all opinions to be heard. Now, with slander, if you make the intentional publication, when you're behind a news outlet with false information, knowingly false information, I think that you should be able to be sued in court more generously with the libel laws that we have in this country. And so the difference is that if you know you have materially false information and you publish it to a big, wide readership, That is not freedom of speech. That is slander. And it's very clear what the Supreme Court has said with that. And so I hope that helps answer your question. So thank you.
Hi, Charlie. Thank you again for being here. My name's Zach Scornavacco, and I was hoping to ask you a little bit more specific about the struggle that our country's small businesses are facing. My mom owns a small business in Southern California that was closed for 5 months due to coronavirus. She's now scraping by on the brink of closure, and we're looking to see the Congress pass possibly some stimulus checks. Do you think that is a responsible response to what our small businesses are facing? I mean, do you think this stimulus will help boost the economy, or do you think it's going to leave us in an even bigger debt?
There are parts of, great question. There are parts of the stimulus that I spoke out against. The part I didn't was the PPP, because these businesses were forced to close their business. They did not willingly do this. They did not make bad decisions. At gunpoint, they were forced to close their businesses. Therefore, I think the government, I think it's under Article 5, the government can't take property from you without reimbursing you. I think they deserve, every small business and business in this country deserve the right to be able to receive those funding. And also, what has happened to our hospitality businesses, our hotel businesses, our restaurants, our bigger restaurants. I'm not just talking about the small ones, because look, $10 million of PPP sounds like a lot, but all of a sudden, if you're running a hotel chain with 400 hotels across the country, you're like, I don't know, 10 million, that kind of caps out. So I think that that is a prop that was perfectly fine. Is it stimulative? Probably not, but it will help end the suffering. So I don't think we should call it a stimulus. I think the best stimulus is free market growth and reopening our country. We want a stimulus? Open America. That's the best stimulus we could possibly have. And so, but I think it is necessary. The part of the stimulus that really drove me nuts was the $75 million for National Public Radio, the $50 million for PBS so that we can pay them through taxpayer dollars to attack people like me. It just is completely outrageous. And so, but you're going to get that graft and corruption and all this sort of nonsense. So thank you. Next question.
Hi, I'm Ryan Bradshaw. I'm a junior at Highland Park High School.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you. In our U.S. history classes, we're taught that there was a party switch, even though this is controversial. What's your opinion on it, and did it actually happen?
What a great question. This is one of the greatest lies taught to our young people. The party's never switched, and I can prove it to you. I'll prove it to you through a couple different ways. Number one, why is it as the South got considerably less racist, it got more Republican? In order for their argument to hold footing, it would have to be as the South got less racist, then it got more Democrat, right? Or it stayed Democrat. Why is it that party switched as the South got way more diverse and accepting that Republicans started to be elected in huge numbers? There is no definitive switch. What did end up happening, though, was one person, Strom Thurmond, that did switch parties towards the end of his life. And that gets pinpointed as the singular switch as the entire parties moved from one to the other. Here's another good argument for you. Why is it that Jimmy Carter announced the re-election campaign in one of the hometowns of the KKK, a Southern Democrat, in 1976? When he was running for re-election against Reagan. It completely blurs the lines on the timeline. It's the Republican Party, and this is the greatest argument of all of them. It's the Republican Party, when we were founded as the Republican Party in Ripon, Wisconsin, that said skin color does not matter. It's the Republican Party that passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act and was the first party to have blacks serve in the United States Senate and the United States Congress. It's the Democrat Party in the 1860s that said skin color matters. Fast forward to today. Which party says skin color matters? The Democrats. They've always cared about skin color, not on characters, not on actions, but they say skin color means something. They have always been a party that has wanted to have control over black people. They've just changed the way they've done it. The movie Uncle Tom articulates that so beautifully. Now, mind you, well-seasoned academics make the argument that there seems to have been a transformational shift. There is not. There's a direct ideological line of the Republican Party of 1864 and the Republican Party of 2020. It's a party that wants aspiration and opportunity for all people, regardless of skin color. It's a party that wants people to break out of their current condition to something better. There's a continual philosophical line from the Democrat Party from 1864 to 2020 that we're going to take care of you and you're going to do what we tell you to do. That's what they said in 1864, and that's what they're saying in 2020. The most tragic thing that happened was after the Civil Rights Act was passed, which was by Republicans, by the way, reluctantly signed into law by a Texan, Lyndon Baines Johnson, that Lyndon Baines Johnson passed the Great Society Act, which ended up being one of the worst things that ever could have possibly happened for Black urban life in this country, where we subsidized fatherlessness, where we destroyed Black businesses, we verticalized the Black community in Chicago, in the urban cities of our country. And you see it in the approach of how the Democrat Party to this day talks to Black voters. If you don't vote for me, you ain't Black. Joe Biden's exact words. Joe Biden in the 1970s was friends with segregationists. He eulogized them. He said that very clearly in the 1990s that our inner cities were jungles, Black men were super predators, and he authored the Clinton crime bill. Which president signed the First Step Act? Was it a Republican or a Democrat? There is a concerted effort by the Democrats to keep Black people, as Candace Owens says, on the metaphorical plantation. Good luck saying that tomorrow in class, but so you could give Candace's book and just kind of just walk away. But they say that Nixon had a Southern strategy. Well, why is it that Dwight D. Eisenhower then, in 1950 and 1954, yeah, that's right. No, I'm not sorry. 1952 and 1956, I'm sorry, when he ran for president. 1952, 1956. Why is it that he started to win Southern states like Tennessee and Arkansas well before the great switch they say that happened? Republican Party of Eisenhower was the party that sent in the federal troops to desegregate the American South. The Republican Party of Eisenhower was the party that demanded the federal government side with the lawsuits on behalf of the Civil Rights Act. And it was Dwight D. Eisenhower that stood in opposition of the segregated armed forces in the 1950s. Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower. And so I encourage, you know, there's some great videos on this, but no, the party's never switched. But what are they really saying when they say the party switched? They're saying this. They're saying that, oh, no, we, the Democrats, we used to be Republicans. So we used to be the good guys. And now we're Democrats and we're still the good guys. That's what they're really trying to say. They're trying to blur the lines of the moral high ground. But make no mistake, it is Republicans that passed for the woman's right to vote, arguing for the woman's right to vote. It is Republicans that passed, like I said, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. It's Republicans that have always cared about every single citizen made in the image of God. Always. Stand proudly on that fact. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, Charlie. I just want to begin by thanking you. As I've become to frequently listen to your podcast.
Thank you.
I have learned why I believe what I do, and I've grown spiritually in ways I didn't even know was possible. So thank you for that.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
My question is you see the left continuing to promote a narrative that says that because of someone's skin color, that they can't succeed in America, that because you're Black, you can't succeed. And I feel like if I was born a Black American today, that I would have no motivation at all to succeed because I'm told that the system completely works against me. My question to you is, how do Republicans combat this narrative and fight against this and start to get Black Americans to believe in the American dream that they have? Because that
it's a phenomenal question. I think it's already starting to happen. And one thing that I'm very proud of that we have done at Turning Point USA is we are on the cutting edge of empowering a lot of these very popular Black voices in the conservative movement. Brandon Tatum, Candace Owens, Terrence Williams, many of them got their political start with us at Turning Point USA, and look at the impact that they're having. I mean, we're talking about millions of people. We at Turning Point USA hosted the first Black Leadership Summit. We did 2 years in a row, and we've always, I think we were ahead of the curve there, and we put lots of resources and lots of time, and you could start to see that really starting to grow. So here's a little nugget for you that's really interesting. The most successful immigrants to America are Nigerian Americans. More successful, more wealthy, higher income than white Americans. If it's impossible for people of Black skin color to succeed, why do Nigerian Americans do so well in our country? Well, maybe because it's possible for anyone to succeed in this country. Nigerian Americans do three things really well. They value family above all, and they have some of the lowest divorce rates in the country. They value education. And they graduate high school and college with little debt at very, very high rates. And the third thing that they do, they graduate high school. The third thing is they're incredibly enterprising, business-minded people. So you do those three things, No matter your skin color, you can succeed in this country. People say there's white privilege. It's nonsense. No one has any privilege in this country based on the color of their skin. There is wealth privilege. There absolutely is wealth privilege. LeBron James's kids will have advantages that most of you will never have. Better doctors, better access to transportation, better communication. And people say, well, more white people are wealthy than black people in this country. On a surface, that's absolutely true. There's also twice as many white people that are in poverty than black people in this country. There's plenty of white people that live in poverty. Just drive through rural Texas and Appalachia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. There's plenty of people that struggle regardless of skin color in this country. The other thing is this. Why is it that the white community does 20% better on income and wealth than the black community in this country? The number one reason is the fatherlessness rate. You can point to the fatherlessness rate as the number one predictor of success in this country, not skin color. Now, the white Americans are not the wealthiest in this country at all. Vietnamese, Korean, Chinese, and Japanese Americans do far better than the average white person in this country, including Indian Americans who have skin and melanin content closest to black Americans. I thought it's impossible for people of dark skin color to succeed in this country. The Constitution was not written in Korean. You can succeed no matter who you are in this country. The data is there. If you apply yourself, if you work hard, if you believe in the system, this thing is built for anyone with aspiration, and it is immoral. In fact, I think it is so incredibly dangerous, disgusting, and wrong to talk to young black people to have them lose faith in this system. Because that's the real tragedy, is a young black kid in this country is told that you can't succeed, and they're starting to believe it. And then they just disengage, and they're less likely to do the things that we know you need to do. And what's really amazing, people say America's a racist country. I go 180. We're the least racist country ever to exist in the history of the world. Period. Bottom line. Least racist. Show me another country that has this many languages, this many cultures, this many skin colors. Every country on the planet is represented in this country. What other country can brag about that? None. Abilene, Texas. 80% Republican Trump support. Just elected a black mayor. Show me how racist the Republican Party is and how racist the conservatives are in this country. There is zero correlation to your skin color to anything that happens in this country. Zero. Systemic police brutality does not exist. A white person is twice as likely to be shot and killed by a police officer in this country. Twice as likely than a black person. In fact, a black person is 18 and a half times more likely to shoot and kill a police officer than a police officer is to shoot and kill them. In fact, according to a Department of Justice survey done by Barack Obama's own DOJ, they found that police departments across the country, 400 of them, were systemically unracist. That police departments go above and beyond to not engage in controversial conduct when it comes to black people in this country. But instead, we pick four or five highly emotive, very controversial, nuanced examples, and we just indict an experiment that has 330 million people, and we say, we must be awful. That is what infants do. That is not what adults do. We should look at data. We should look at empirical evidence. We should look at the nuance. And here's the final thing. If we were so racist, why is that 3 million black people immigrated to this country since 1980? 3 million. 3 million people, 2 million from Africa, 1 million from the Caribbean. The reason is that we're actually the greatest place for any person, any skin color to succeed. And black Americans in this country are the 18th wealthiest country on the planet. If you just take black Americans, there's a growing black middle class. And thanks to President Trump, lowest ever black poverty rate, lowest ever black unemployment rate, highest ever black entrepreneurship rate, opportunity zones, historical black college universities. Most of that does not get conveyed or communicated in the media. So what we have to do is get back to the American idea of e pluribus unum, which is this. Your skin color means nothing. It's completely irrelevant. I don't care, and you shouldn't either. In fact, if you care, you're a racist. I don't want to talk about people's skin color anymore. If you're trying to tell me I have certain privilege and you don't, or you can't be racist and all this, then you care about melanin a lot more than I do. And you know who you know who used to do this in this country? The KKK. That's what we got away from, everybody. That's why we had a civil rights movement in this country. We had a moment in time that I grew up in, and many of you remember, just 10 years ago, where we said, if you work hard and play by the rules, you can succeed regardless of skin color. We have to get back to a country where we stop looking at people based on the melanin content and hyper-racializing things. Because if we don't, we all know that it's not going to be good where we're headed. Thank you for your question. We'll do one more.
First, I wanted to say thank you for having us. My name is Lila DeVega. I'm a senior at Highland Park High School. And I was wondering if policies regarding COVID-19, such as social distancing and wearing a mask, will be loosened after the election. And if so, what will it look like if Trump wins versus if Biden wins?
Yeah, I have a feeling that, great question. Thank you for being here. I have a feeling that if this, once this election comes, a lot of these things are going to be lifted. I'm all for individual liberty and individual choice. I actually believe people say my body, my choice. Sure. Okay, great. If you believe masks work, then you should have the liberty to do that. That's fine. Dr. Fauci said himself, it does not work back in March. He said it again in April and they reversed position. I have not seen the white paper that supports that. I am very, very skeptical against government central authorities telling people how to live their lives, especially with ever-changing narratives and contradicting data and the human cost that we have seen. I think it is so incredibly immoral to make high school kids socially distance and wear masks. There is no evidence to support this whatsoever. No high school in America should do this. Zero. None. There is no evidence whatsoever to support countries that locked down, that had any sort of change in hospitalization or death rates, or countries that didn't. There is no data whatsoever to support. And I'm willing to go toe-to-toe with anyone on this, because we have the data. And Heather McDonald did an unbelievable story on this, that wear masks or not. Again, if you believe they work, then wear one. Please. That's what liberty is all about. If you are at risk, make good choices. But don't go to the government, which has all the power, and prevent other people from being able to make choices to assemble. Especially when it comes to young people, it is a travesty what we have done in this country. Canceling prom, graduation, spring sports, summer sports. We see the numbers. There will be a decade of unraveling because of what we have done in this country. And so a lot of this will go away after the election. I just think that there's actually going to be a lot of unintended consequences. I think that a lot of people are so fed up with this nonsense that they're actually going to look to the one party that wants a reopening of this country. And I actually think a lot of the one size fits all policies that have gone towards this thing is actually going to backfire tremendously. I really do. So thank you so much for your question. We appreciate that. So
thanks so much for listening, everybody. If you want to get involved with Turning Point USA, go to tpusa.com. That is tpusa.com. Email us your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com. As you can see, we are doing 3 episodes a day. We are doubling and tripling down because we have a country to save. I can't sit still. We have 6 days. I will not be able to live with myself if Joe Biden becomes president of the United States and I didn't give everything I possibly could. I encourage you to go submit your ballots, vote early, get your friends to do the same, obsess over it. It's 6 days, everybody. Our republic is at stake. And if you just can't do it and you're busy, then help give us the ammunition to help get the truth out at charliekirk.com/support. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Listen to our sister and our brother episode today. We have a whole family of episodes today. God bless. Talk to you soon.